This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Osama bin Laden has lost his free access to television audiences in the United States. At the urging of White House National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, the five major TV news networks yesterday agreed to limit their coverage of any future videotaped statements from the alleged terrorist. One news executive called it a patriotic wart, always created a conflict for reporters and the press. Should the press corps join the war effort, even embrace censorship? Or is it more important for the news media to maintain an open flow of information to the country? First, the balancing act in Pakistan. Today, Pakistan officials acknowledged that U.S. military forces have arrived in their country. They've granted the U.S. use of several air bases, although not, they say, to launch attacks. But this hospitality carries real risks for Pakistan President General Pervez Musharraf. The majority of citizens reportedly oppose involvement in the war against Osama bin Laden and the Taliban government in Afghanistan. Scott Baldoff covers Pakistan for the Christian Science Monitor. We spoke to him earlier from Islamabad. Scott, there are big demonstrations planned for tomorrow after Friday prayers. Are the Islamic radicals' calls to jihad beginning to reach the more moderate Pakistan population?
Thus far, they have not reached the more moderate forces in Pakistan. But this set of demonstrations starting tomorrow, Friday, would that's where things could really turn. There could be some changes there. But largely the reason being this. This will be the first set of Friday demonstrations since the attacks began. There have been reports of civilian deaths, mosques hit by bombs. So there could be a larger than normal crowds here, and more than just the usual group of Muslims who attend madrasas and such.
What's likely to be the government response? Are they better prepared for the possibility of violence now than several days ago when there were violent outbreaks in Quetta and elsewhere?
Absolutely. In fact, in Islamabad itself, there are a number of army checkpoints that have sprouted up in the past couple of days. You've got sandbag emplacements near the Parliament building, and interestingly enough, near the hotels, the major hotels where journalists are staying. Mm-hmm. So they are preparing themselves for potential violence. Yet it's not clear that these demonstrations are going to be violent. This will just remain to see tomorrow.
Is the presence of U.S. military forces now widely known among Pakistanis? What's the reaction been?
Well, it's page one news in all the papers. There is a piece in the paper today about U.S. planes arriving in the northern Pakistani city of Jacobabad. And that is a very delicate, very sensitive subject for Pakistanis. Here they tend to view this as Americans beating up on Muslims, and they see themselves as needing to defend their Muslim brothers. That is a very sensitive issue, and certainly so for the Pakistani president, because he has come out so much in favor of the U.S.-led coalition.
Pakistan's president has so far offered his support for America, but he's clearly been worried about dissent in his government and in his population. How firm is Musharraf's hold?
His control seems to be pretty firm. The reason being he just reshuffled his cabinet, shifted out a number of people who are seen to be pro-Taliban within the armed forces, and by doing that, he has firmed up his support. But on the other hand, he may also have isolated himself from people within the army ranks who are sympathetic towards the Taliban. His control over the civil government seems to be firm as well. But again, is the man in touch with the majority of the population, or is he simply becoming more close to the West?
Are there signs of factions less friendly to the United States jockeying to seize power from Musharraf?
That is not so clear. There obviously are the religious parties, which are firmly opposed to Musharraf, and they're actually calling very vocally for jihad against America, for a holy war against the United States, and for those who sympathize with the United States and support the United States against the Taliban. he seems to have the majority of the mainstream parties behind him, the most of the politicians behind him, and for the most part, thus far, seems to have the middle class. But the middle class is a small grouping in Pakistan. So how much control does he really have over society is not all that clear.
Scott, Pakistan is a nuclear power. How secure are Pakistan's nuclear weapons? Where are they, and who's guarding them?
Well, the nuclear weapons are at a facility in a town called Kohuta. This is a military garrison, and it is very, very secret. You have to have security clearance to go through it or even close to it. If a journalist was caught taking pictures of even the sign leading to the road to Kohuta, he would probably have his camera confiscated. So it's very, very well guarded. But then again, who's guarding that nuclear installation? It's crack troops of the of Pakistan's special forces, and you have to question whether or not those people are in line with what Musharraf's in charge and what he's trying to do.
The military has nursed pro-Taliban factions within it.
Within the military, yes, it has for a number of years, and that has also been led by the military intelligence, known as the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, or the ISI. It's very difficult to turn 180 degrees away from a policy that the Pakistan's been pursuing for what now six, seven years. So I would imagine there are going to be those within the military and within the ISI who would like to keep things going the way they were.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Baldoff covers Pakistan for the Christian Science Monitor. He joined us earlier from Islamabad. On Wednesday, Osama bin Laden delivered his latest threats to America on television. It may be his last unfiltered message to America. At the request of the White House, the major networks have agreed to censor future statements, cutting out what might be inflammatory remarks. What is the proper role of the press in wartime? Is it un-American to report the news when the news may be contrary to U.S. interests? What's your view? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Joining us tonight from New York is Mark Crispin Miller. He's a journalist, author, and professor of media studies at New York University. Good evening, Professor Miller.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good to have you.
Thanks.
Also joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hey, Tom. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Jack. How are you?
Fine.
Mark Miller, you've written about the press, censorship, and propaganda. What do you make of the networks clamping down on Osama bin Laden's access to American TV screens?
Well, I find it troubling. I think I can understand the logic behind the request, but I don't think it's in the best interests of the American people to have the primary sources of their news and information about the world acting to protect them against some threat, which I guess our government thinks we can't really handle rationally. I understand that one of the reasons given for the request that the networks censor the bin Laden speeches mm-hmm. is that he might be giving he might be sending signals to his followers. Who the thinking evidently goes would be watching CBS or CNN to find out what to do next in order to inflict grievous harm on the American people.
You find it credible?
I don't find it credible. It reminds me of the big story about Clinton's necktie. I just don't buy it. But even if it is the case that that Osama bin Laden is resorting to that kind of sneaky method, it seems to me that having the major networks censor his appearances isn't going to do any good. God knows the web is easily accessible to anyone. There are all kinds of ways in which his putative sleeper agents might pick up information from him. But I don't believe it, and I think that the reason why that incredible explanation was floated is that it really is hard to justify the request on any other grounds. It reminds me of the thinking about propaganda that was commonplace during the Cold War. there was a notion that enemy propaganda, and it's really older than the Cold War, but mm-hmm. there's a notion that enemy propaganda is somehow fatally intoxicating. It acts a little bit like a virus, so that if people are unwittingly exposed to it, they might be infected and become zombified troops, for our great foe. I think that's extremely unlikely.
Condoleezza Rice reportedly made an observation along those lines to the top television news network executives that she spoke with, saying that Osama bin Laden was a charismatic figure and that at the least his remarks could inflame anti-American hatred and maybe anti-American violence.
Well, I'm sure his remarks do that. I'm sure they also do it more dangerously and more extensively outside of our borders. Whether or not the networks choose to show him here doesn't necessarily mean that other networks won't be able to show what he has to say. And as we know, Al Jazeera is the network that was showing his speech in the first place.
The satellite TV channel out of Qatar in the Middle
Qatar,
East.
Exactly. And our government has been trying to persuade the Qatari government to crack down on that network, which is the only independent network in the Arab world. But let me say that although I agree with Dr. Rice when she says that Osama bin Laden exerts a kind of fatal fascination for many of the Arab masses, I think that censoring him domestically won't do anything but augment his appeal. It makes him seem more glamorous. Conversely, I would also add that a lot of people, not necessarily only Americans, who tend to distrust what our government has to say, mm-hmm. and there's been such pervasive distrust, at least since the war in Vietnam, it's really a good thing for people like that to see what Osama bin Laden has to say with his own mouth, because it's not coming to that audience filtered through government statements or interpretations. There he is, preaching jihad, mm-hmm. celebrating mass murder. I mean, he's pretty straightforward about it.
It's incredibly informative at some level, even if it's a horrible sounding message.
Well, it's a horrible sounding message, and I have enough faith in the American people to think that the great majority of them can perceive that for themselves. So what I object to about this, both the government's request and the network's ready compliance with it, is that it at some level expresses a certain distrust of the American people. I mean, I'm a complete small D Democrat, probably to a naive extent, but I think that when the American people have sufficient information about things, they by and large have tended to make admirable decisions and choices. Mm. I think that this move is expressive of a certain distrust of the audience, and I find that troubling.
Jack Beatty, how about from your perspective? Here is a charismatic guy who, though most of us don't speak Arabic, certainly looks well-spoken, delivering this virulently anti-American, even anti-Western, some would say civilization as we know it message. Does he deserve a place on American television, or does he deserve to be abridged and pruned back, as the networks have now agreed?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think in the instant case, I probably agree with Mark that in fact, just showing his effectless narrative of mass murder, we're seeing a kind of moral monster there. And no amount of propaganda could ever make that worse, it seems to me. The truth is there in all its unspeakable reality. Having said that, though, I am very worried, and I think maybe Mark might share a little of this, about the symbiotic relationship between terror and TV. There's a good article about this in The American Prospect by Scott Stossel. And he points out that terror, unlike, say, the Wehrmacht, operates not by conquering territory, but by making people afraid, by producing it's like a kind of political theater. It specializes in theatrical violence, of which we saw the absolute worst on September 11th, and that there's a kind of penumbra of fear and distrust that is the aftershock of that event.
Jack, hold that, and Mark Miller, hold your response. We'll come back to that. TV, terror, the American press, and should there be wartime censorship? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Details of the U.S. airstrikes today are mapped out and illustrated on our website, target locations, satellite photos, and more at WBUR.org under Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're taking a quick break. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the press in wartime and what restrictions, if any, there should be on the information flowing to the American people. Are you prepared to restrict the press to win this war on terrorism? Do you think that's required? If the press is restricted, do you think you'll be adequately informed? We're joined this hour by Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media studies at New York University, currently at work on a book about propaganda practices in the United States, and with Jack Beatty, special coverage news analyst. Mark Miller, Jack was making the point just before the break that TV and terrorism are a very potent combination. And Lord knows we saw that in the biggest possible way in Manhattan when the towers came down. There's a kind of magnification that goes on here, and terror is, of course, all about a psychological game. Does that make this media question somehow different from the straight old news question?
Well, no, Jack raises a crucially important question, and there is no question about the fact that the terrorists struck as they struck in New York and in Washington so as to reap the maximum terroristic benefit from having this take place on everybody's television screens. I mean, I live a mile from Ground Zero, and I had the bizarre and horrible experience of watching the thing both in reality and on television. I take this whole thing extremely seriously, as I know most Americans
do.
But let me make a point about Jack's observation, which I agree with completely. I actually fault the American media for having in its constant obsession with ratings points and advertising revenues, for having really erred more on the side of alarmism and terroristic practice than has been necessary or than is really than has been useful to the American people.
On the other hand, how can you be too alarmed about the World Trade Center crumbling into dust?
No. Absolutely, and I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that they oughtn't to have covered it in a way to upset us. It was far too upsetting for anyone to cover it in a way that wouldn't simply make us all terrified, anxious, and depressed. It's had that effect on everybody I know, everybody who's watched TV. But I'm talking more about the subsequent coverage, not simply the coverage of the atrocity itself, but the coverage, for example, the coverage of bioterrorism. I believe that news can be alarming and at the same time productively carried out so that we actually are edified. We know more about what happened. We know more about why what happened, and we know more about what we might do to protect ourselves in the future. Now, for example, all the recent coverage of bioterrorism, which is definitely a serious threat and extremely scary, the coverage has tended to be vague, alarmist in the worst way. At the same time, I have not seen any mainstream coverage at all of the flawed response by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, to the first outbreak in Florida.
Mark Miller, we take your point there, but we're talking tonight not so much about what we are getting in the news, but what we may not be hearing in the news.
I want
to open our lines for a second. We're glad to have with us Paul Friedman. Paul Friedman is Executive Vice President of ABC News. Welcome, Paul Friedman.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight. We've been talking about the press and press restrictions in a time of war and then this new sort of war. ABC was among the five U.S. networks that yesterday agreed to abridge its coverage of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda's statements. Why did ABC agree to do that, and what exactly did you agree to do and not to do?
Well, we didn't agree to do that. It's been badly reported that we did. We had a totally legitimate request from Dr. Rice from the White House saying, just be careful, just consider the effects of putting these things on live without any chance to edit or review and at unedited length. Just think about that before you do it. And it's a perfectly reasonable nothing to raise. There was no threat. There was no specific request. And we made absolutely no promises to the government.
But the national reporting has been that the five networks collectively agreed among themselves to abridge these statements, to cut out inflammatory language. And it was specifically reported that ABC said it would not show moving images from the tapes. Is that not correct?
None of it is correct, and I think you'll see a correction in the New York Times tomorrow, for example, which had the most egregiously incorrect reporting on this subject.
Well, here we are in the fog of war.
Here we are in the fog of war. It happens to the best of us. All we said, and there was a conference among the news division presidents after the conversation with Dr. Rice, and that conversation ended with a general acknowledgement by all of those people, we're going to continue to do what we do, which is we look at these things and we decide what to put on the air. That's the editing function. And that's what we'll continue to do. We
but
did
Paul
not
Friedman,
promise.
We're all for the editing function and we applaud it. But yet, is there not, even by a kind of wink and nod, some kind of consensus here to hold back on the amount of airtime that Osama bin Laden gets? We know it would be hard for any network to hold back if another didn't.
I didn't wink and nod at anybody. David Weston didn't wink and nod at anybody. And I don't think that's taken place. In fact, I've said to people today, I was in the control room on Sunday when the bin Laden footage became available. I made the decision to put it on the air. I would make that decision again in a similar situation.
Well, let me
ask
you.
On the other hand, we did not put on the spokesman the day before yesterday. Because it just didn't make any sense to put on a spokesman who was not a principal in the story when we could take a look at it and see what he said.
Let me ask you this way. After the conversation with Condoleezza Rice, do you believe that U.S. networks will show any greater degree of restraint in broadcasting messages from Al-Qaeda?
I don't think that my news division will show any different response.
This is Jack Beatty. Was there mm-hmm. another message there, too, perhaps? The administration now has approval ratings around 90%.
Mm-hmm.
And was there an implicit sort of political message there that look, we understand that you, the media, although you're doing better, are among the most despised institutions in American life, and we're sitting on all this political capital.
Mm-hmm.
And the message here is, look, we don't want to try to turn the nation against you, boys. We want to keep, bathe in this patriotic aura with us, fellas, because we could turn it against you. Is there any feeling of that among you gentlemen?
None whatsoever. In fact, none at all. And we have all been through lots of conversations in our careers that were a lot tougher than that one. I can remember Chuck Colson calling me in control room during Watergate and saying, you change that program or else. And we didn't. And that's not the way it operates. In fact, the more important thing to focus on is that our evening newscast, World News Tonight, last night, led with a very tough piece which said, we're 4 days into this war, and the United States government has not given us anything more than three very bad photos to describe what it has been doing in Afghanistan. I don't think it's any surprise or any coincidence that today they started giving more information. I don't think we've been intimidated into being patriotic to the point of following some sort of implicit orders from the White House.
We hear you and we applaud the sentiment, and yet it's hard. We're looking at quotes. Andrew Hayward, president of CBS News, says, given the historic events we're enmeshed in, it's appropriate to explore new ways of fulfilling our responsibilities to the public.
Well, that sounds okay to me.
But new ways, is that not?
I don't know what his new ways are.
Walter Isaacson, chairman of CNN, after hearing Dr. Rice, we're not going to step on the landmines she was talking about. These both sound like new restraint of some kind being embraced.
I don't know what Walter was talking about, frankly. It may be that he was reacting to this idea that embedded in these public statements by bin Laden mm-hmm. or his spokesman are some sort of codes that she urged us to think about. And by the way, she said she can't prove it's happening. They're still analyzing the tapes. She was very clear about that. And she didn't say it's there, therefore you must not do it. And that may be what Walter was referring to.
Well, Paul Friedman, this is truly a fascinating situation where the country is a little bit up in arms over these new steps that were reportedly taking, and you're saying they're not been taken.
They have not been taken, and I frankly think all the attention. I suppose it's an automatic when somebody from the White House talks to news executives, people, and I guess there's some comfort in it, worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, it happens all the time. There's a constant exchange. Mm-hmm. The only thing that was unusual about this was there was a conference call. Civilized way of doing business, no big deal.
Paul Friedman, Executive Vice President of ABC News, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
You're welcome.
Mark Miller?
Yes.
You heard that. You're looking at the press. The New York Times has reported it just the other way around and in great detail. Are you accepting this? Do you believe it? What do you make of this?
Let me preface my reply by saying that I actually think that ABC has done the best job in general of all five of the networks. I think that Peter Jennings in particular has done the best job, and I'm extremely heartened to hear. I didn't get to watch the broadcast tonight, but I'm heartened to hear that ABC has demanded more information because so far the blackout has been total, and it certainly is incumbent on any serious news professional to demand to know a little bit more about what's going on. Having said that, though, I must say that I thought the gist of your and Jack's questions was right on. And I also think that it's a little bit pointless to ask someone in Paul's position to confirm or deny whether there was any kind of tacit coercion. The fact is we have the federal government in an hour of acute national crisis basically calling all the heads of the networks together for a conference call. And I'm sure it was more civilized than the way Charles Colson dealt with people. But that doesn't make it any less coercive. It may even make it more coercive.
It wouldn't pass the antitrust sniff test.
Not mine.
We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Do you feel that Washington is clamping down on the hose of information coming to us from Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda? Would you be sorry if they did? Do you wish they would? Call us. Let us know what you think. Paul is on the line. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I actually applaud the government's move, and I applaud the networks for wanting to hold back some of this information. We are so terrorized and so fearful right now. I have to tell you, well, this week I should have been on a trip to Europe, and last week the government issued a public announcement about travel to Italy. I'm somewhat suspicious of the motives of government at times, but I have to tell you, I think the government is trying to protect its citizens. In this instance, I think so much of what's coming out in the papers, and the one thing I don't hear at all here, is the fact that some of what's coming out is really creating a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment in this country. I didn't hear anybody say that so far, but for example, last week we saw a Time magazine with bin Laden's picture on the front of it, and my wife flipped it over. She was horrified by the picture. She didn't want to see it anymore.
It was a frightening picture. I don't think it was bin Laden, but it was an enraged Pakistani rioter. My 7-year-old daughter hit it with her fist when she saw it. It was a visceral response. It was such an aggressive photograph. But Paul, would you then think we're saving Osama bin Laden from himself by not putting him on U.S. television? You're happy if the government shuts down on that information flow?
I am. I'm happy that they should, because I think we're never going to be able to – we have to be able to operate, and we have to move on and be able to function in a way that's productive for our economy and for this war. I mean, and I think that in some ways where our effectiveness is being harmed by the over-publicizing bin Laden's statements and his picture in our faces constantly. We know who he is. There'll be a sufficient amount of information put out
by
the networks.
We got it. Thank you, Paul, for your call. Jack Beatty, what about that? Is this a typical response in wartime? Did Americans want Hitler banished from the pages of their magazines and newspapers in World War II? Do we not want to see the boogeyman?
Well, no. I mean, I think that but in World War II, reporters really took to heart Paul's outlook. Let me just read a bit from John Steinbeck. He covered the war. He said, "We were all part of the war effort. We went along with it. And not only that, we abetted it. Gradually, it became a part of us that the truth about anything was automatically secret and that to trifle with it was to interfere with the war effort. By this, I don't mean that the correspondents were liars. They were not. It is in the things not mentioned that the untruth lies."
The things not mentioned.
So people internalized that standard when the nation's survival was at risk. And, of course, it was very different in Vietnam. We had a similar situation to what just happened. President Kennedy called up Henry Luce and complained about a Time magazine correspondent in Vietnam who had written that the war is we are losing the war, and his copy was changed to say the opposite. News management, it was called at the time, but it was quite right in line with what has been the practice of presidents in wartime. General Sherman wanted to shoot a reporter. It was only by intercession with Lincoln, from Lincoln, that he stopped. Secretary Stanton wanted to court-martial reporters. General MacArthur would court-martial anyone who spoke to a reporter. Unfortunately, military activity where people's lives are on the line, the interests of the soldier and the interests of the press do not coincide in those moments. And I think the president and I think the security people have a point about that, that's just a reality about reporting in time of war, and especially on the medium of television, which in a certain extent is the enemy within. I mean, that's the terrorism right there. We turn it on, it's there. People for years have talked about the anti-civic character of television, that it dries down voting, that it gives people a much grimmer idea of the world than the world really is.
But Jack, the world has finally worsened
up to it.
But Jack, wasn't it our communal hearth during this crisis? I think a lot of people were riveted to it and took comfort from the messages there and the reporting there.
I think so. I think there was a lot of that. But even there, Peter Jennings, on I think the first day of coverage, which I thought he did a I agree with Mark, he was terrific. But he made a comment contrasting, how presidents in wartime how John Kennedy, I think, stayed in the White House during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and President Bush was having a hard time getting back to it. Well, he had hundreds of thousands of people protesting what was a factual observation about.
Well, that kind of Bush
was having trouble getting back to
the White
House.
Yeah, Jack Beatty and Mark Miller, we thought that Paul Friedman had gone back to work, but he's still with us and wants to respond to some of what's been unfolding here. Paul Friedman, Executive VP at ABC News, are you there?
I appreciate you giving me this chance. I have to go worry about putting the President of the United States on the air right now.
And we've just got a minute before the break, Paul.
Just one quick thing. It's not fair to say that the questions were legitimate, but my answers don't pass the sniff test about whether we're going to be coerced. What I suggest to you is that this tension between government and media exists all the time, and you have to judge what the media do by what happens, not by some kind of reflexive assumption that the media will cave, that they're victims of coercion.
Paul, we will resist the reflexive assumption, and we will keep the skeptical eye that arises here. But thanks for coming back on. That's Paul Friedman, Executive VP at ABC News. Mark Miller, we've just got 30 seconds, but you had a point.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that obviously the interests of the press and the interests of the soldier are often at cross purposes, but all too often authority tends to use operational security as an excuse to clamp down on other kinds of stories. The president tried to further limit the number of congressmen who could get intelligence briefings recently by claiming that the leaked item there might be further domestic terrorist attacks was somehow going to hurt our troops in Afghanistan. That really makes no sense. I think we have to make a distinction between militarily sensitive stories, which no one wants revealed recklessly, and the vast array of other kinds of stories that really do affect our lives.
Mark Miller will dive further in when we come back from a short break. We're talking about the American media in a new kind of war situation. What information, if any, are you willing to let go of for the sake of national security? And does clamping down improve national security? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the American media in the midst of a new kind of war. Do you trust the government to decide what you should know? Do you trust them a little? Do you trust them a lot? Do you wish they'd clamp down, or do you want a free flow of information in an era when all kinds of information, even Osama bin Laden himself, can flow straight onto your TV screen at any time? We're talking tonight with Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media studies at New York University, and our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. We have a lot of calls stacked up, people wanting to join. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Let's turn to the phones. Helen is on the line. Welcome, Helen. You're on the air.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you.
My comment is that I really felt that the government had stirred up a lot more Americans' concerns, unlike the caller before. I felt that the comments of, that this video may contain, things that will call up Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda's network, I think from what I've heard from my colleagues and friends, that this has caused more fear in Americans that we would play something so poorly, you know, that why would they play that? And honestly, I believe it was just propaganda to stir up more nationalism, more excitement, and more fear in Americans. And I feel that the government should leave it up to my mind not to preface any kind of view, any kind of video, and leave it up to my mind that I'm an intelligent human being that is able to decide whether, you know, it's something that I want to view or not.
But Helen, I got to ask you, don't you think there's already just about as much patriotism and nationalism in the air as any government could possibly want, even in wartime?
Exactly, but I really felt that their statements caused more fear than what they were hoping. I really felt that, you know, I limit the amount of television that I watch. I listen to NPR as the main source of my information. You know, instead of hanging on every sensationalized thing on television with their branding and their logos, and I feel that, you know, that the Americans have a right to view. Obviously, if it's a case of national security, it's not something that we should be watching, but if it's safe enough for them to even think that we should have the opportunity to watch it, I think that it shouldn't be something that's censored.
Helen,
and I don't think, yes.
Thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Miller, there you hear. It's an interesting combination. It's the government stirring up more fear on the back of videotapes from Osama bin Laden, who is a fairly scary guy.
Well, he is a scary guy, but I take Helen's point. I think she makes a good point. The claim that there's some kind of secret message embedded in his epaulets or in his beard or something makes him not just scarier, but scary in a kind of fantastic way, that he's exerting some kind of supernatural power that can rouse his robotic followers from their hiding places and strike us once again. You know, her call, in combination with Paul's call before, you know, together they make an important point, which is that terror, fear, is contrary to the interests of democracy. We have come closest in our short history as a nation, closest to losing our precious and definitive freedoms at those moments when the general population has been most frightened of an enemy. From 1798, when the enemy seemed to be the French and which saw the passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts, up to the present moment, I think that Paul's attitude that I don't want to know anything, the government will take care of me, I find that terribly scary. I would like to know, for example, like to know more about how certain government agencies failed us in the first place, how you know, the state of our airline security, our airport security was so poor that these guys were able to hijack these jets. I'd like to know more about the CIA's failures. Seymour Hersh did a superb piece in the latest New Yorker on this, but I haven't seen any mainstream media analysis. And I've noticed that the government, the White House, and Congress have been very quick to absolve the CIA of all blame.
Mark,
not the kind of coverage that suits a great democracy whose citizens really ought to know what's going on. And I think we're at greater risk if we don't know.
Jack, do you feel you're suffering information deprivation in the last month?
Well, I'm getting a lot of information, but I think Mark is right about that the kind of indignation that we have about that this happened and that the various failures involved in it, isn't being addressed. I feel frustrated about that, and maybe it's even hurting us, because if we're not being honest about how bad our intelligence agencies are, then we're not going to really reform them enough to be up to the scale of this threat. The most frightening thing I heard on television was the first night of this, when Peter Jennings turned to his Pentagon correspondent and said, "Are you telling me that the military does not trust the civilian intelligence agencies?" And the correspondent said, "Yes, that's what I'm telling you. The military doesn't trust CIA and the FBI."
We're looking at what role and how open the American media ought to keep information flowing in this information age, when a terrorist sitting in front of Iraq and Afghanistan can broadcast his image and message to the entire world. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What are your thoughts? Gary is on the line. Welcome, Gary.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for having me on here.
Good to have you.
Just wanted to raise a quick point. I know we don't have much time left, but I kind of agree with the original caller The fact that I feel that we do have to classify some information coming in, allowing an individual such as Osama bin Laden just to be able to freely broadcast over the United States airwaves, I think if we hinder that a little bit, and I think Dr. Rice was just looking at the point saying, listen, we're not entirely sure if there are subliminal messages. We just want to ensure that first, and then we'll declassify certain portions of it afterwards. I think if we just take the step in advance just to ensure the national security and safety of the individuals in the United States, it might go a long way. Now, I'm 100% completely 100% for free speech and, you know, freedom of the press, and I think they do a wonderful job. I just think that as Americans, we've become so, you know, in tune to almost like the arcade war, the Gulf War, where we got to see every single thing that occurred in that military fraction due to the fact that it was such an easy war. We were in and out, and it's not that situation.
We got it. We got it. Gary, thanks for your call. I think Jack Beatty, he was speaking of your comment. But there you hear, there's an American trying to parse this, applauding press freedom and yet saying, I'm willing to give up some margin for greater security. Are those compatible ideas?
I think they have been made compatible in the crucible of experience. I mm-hmm. think every war has worked this out. And often it's been that, unfortunately, press freedom has been abridged. But
maybe that's necessary to some extent in war. Mark Miller, do you allow that it's ever necessary? Sorry, Jack.
Go ahead. Say that again. I'm sorry.
Do you allow that it might ever be necessary in wartime to put some restrictions on press coverage?
Well, I think that if you look back at the history of press coverage during wars, you'll see that relations between the press and the military and the government have actually been pretty cordial. Most reporters have been real patriots. There's a myth, there's a legend that the press was somehow anti-war during Vietnam and stabbed the nation in the back and so on. But there are some excellent books, including one by an Army historian named William Hammond, which make clear that was simply not the case. My complaint, I think the important point for us to realize here is that we are deprived of information not through government fiat. I mean, we're not really deprived of information because the White House is interfering with how the networks operate. We're deprived of information because the networks do a really lousy job of informing us. I mean, think back to what was on TV nonstop up until the atrocities took place on 9/11. It was all Gary Condit all the time. It was stuff about the latest installment of Survivor. There was some stuff about the new Harry Potter movie. I mean, it was all triviality. It was all lurid.
And meanwhile, a hurricane was brewing in the mountains of Afghanistan.
Well, you can say that again. Yeah. We ought to have known a lot more about what was going on, and we ought to have known a lot more about our recent past. I mean, to some extent, the educational establishment is at fault here. But our journalists don't really do investigative reporting. They sit around and wait for the Pentagon to hand them something usable, and they complain when they don't get it. Meanwhile, there are countless stories that are going neglected because, the authorities in D.C. don't see fit to discuss them. So that's the end of it. I think that's a very serious problem.
Mark, we're almost at the end of our time. A final thought, Jack Beatty. Here we are in an information age, and still Mark Miller is saying we're not getting the information we need when we need it, and sometimes we get what we don't need when we don't need it. We're swamped in information. It doesn't feel like censorship here. It feels like the opposite.
Yeah, but the question is, what's the hierarchy of importance of the information mm-hmm. we're getting?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the information with consequence? And it's just been a habit of governments, as Mark has said, throughout history, to shield their own mistakes in patriotism, to try to drape themselves in the flag so that the reflection won't be on them and their practices and their handling of the war. That's just the way politics has worked. The politics of war has worked.
And we haven't even begun this evening to address the issue of reporting from the field, on the ground where the battle's going on, the almost complete blackout there. We'll have to get to it another time. Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media at New York University, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks, Jack.
Good, thank you, Mark.
Good to have you too, Jack. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Click on WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums to learn more and talk more about the role of the American media in the midst of this new kind of war. Now, a story about the abrupt end of one woman's romance with life as an expatriate. Margaret moved to Europe 5 years ago. The events of September 11th have uncovered the American beneath the world citizen.
What I think most about these days is how to get home, to find a way back across the Atlantic to confront this new war on my soil. When I first came to Germany almost a year ago, I thought the winter fog and fields of mud would be the hardest part. Then spring came and the skies cleared, the ground hardened. Summer was easy, bright and blue. I forgot the dark season's depression as easily as I had the labor pains between children. Then came September, and like a switch, the sun was gone, the fog returned, the soil turned soft. And I remembered, railed against what was to come. What came was the 11th, and now when I wake to the fog, I say a prayer of thanks, hoping the layer of gray will make me invisible to the Luftwaffe flying their ear-splitting scrambles over my roof. Since the 11th, living on a hilltop makes me feel vulnerable. The clay in the ground has turned to its annual goop, but this time it doesn't matter. I won't be going out so often this year for walks in the woods. I've not gone much into the city this past month, but the few times I have, I've fretted for the first time that maybe I really do look as American as people have said. And I wonder if it's time to retire my backpack, trade in my jeans for slacks. I no longer try out my German on clerks in the stores. I make sure to just get what I need and hand over my money. Downtown seems to have changed a bit, too. There aren't quite as many people out shopping, and those who are seem more alert. Long-coated Muslim women, once dotting the streets with their children in hand, are now few and far between. I've seen police hauling away ethnic men. I look across the fast-flowing Danube and wonder just where it was they found that reported cell. I gather my bags and hurry back to my hill. Once there, I turn on my TV, CNN, my own English channel now since Sky News went digital. Last week, the news didn't seem to change much from day to day, but now the Allied attacks have begun, and I find it necessary to keep the TV running even when I'm out of the room, because it's far easier to approach a screen already in motion than face the anxiety of what could be lurking behind a blank one. Sometimes I flip to local broadcasts, but then all I see are the pictures, and the spate of foreign words added to them only makes it all seem as alien as the act itself. My German isn't good enough yet to follow along, but then the vocabulary I'd need just now wasn't ever part of the plan. The hardest part has been accessing the events. I've had some news, emails, the phone. What's missing is the physical person to talk to, another American. Someone to rant with and rage, someone to hug, someone to shed the same hot tears. I used to joke that my move abroad had turned me expat. The 11th taught me that I'm more American than I'd ever let myself know. It seems naive to have taken so much for granted. I want to wear my own clothes and fly my own flag without thinking of State Department advisories. I want to speak my language, not only the words, but all the rest that goes with it. Some locals I know have said how lucky I am. I could have been there, but they're greatly mistaken. For all of my soul, it's where I already am. The president said we should get back to normal. So I think of the ocean that seems more like a wall than infinite beads of water. And I plan how to cross it so I can get back. Because what I want most is to be home.
Margaret lives in Germany. Citing advice from the U.S. State Department for Americans abroad to keep a low profile, Margaret requested that we identify her by her first name only. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How are the attacks in Afghanistan affecting you? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. Read transcripts of the radio diaries featured on our special coverage on our website. Log on to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.